There are some speakers in the astrological community whose oratorical style is so brilliant that it doesn't matter whether they have anything to say or not. I am happy to say that the following speaker also has something to say. But her oratorical style is also that brilliant. So combining genuine content with a genuinely exciting style of delivery, I offer you Carolyn Casey.
We first supplicate Jupiter, open our paths before us and grant us the opportunity to be of maximum good in the world. So welcome, allies. And it's taken us a long time to gather here. An ancient prophecy that we are just now making up has said that these people would gather in a temple disguised as a hotel. Or possibly one of the lower realms of hell disguised as a hotel. Happy Valentine's Day, allies. This is the gathering of the tribes. And right now, the moon is sailing overhead. And for the last couple of hours, the Sabian symbol for the moon has been men drilling for oil. But right now, it has just changed its degree, and now the symbol for the moon is an oasis. So in the midst of this, we're in the oasis. In the midst of this busy Jupiter, Uranus, wild, frenzied time, where the stories we tell ourselves are on an energetic, alternating pulse. Things are fine, they're going really well. No, oh my God, it's going to go. No, things are fine, they're really well. Oh my God, they're going to go. So there's this pulse, and so we use time now to step out of time. So the image for the oasis is contact with inner wellsprings, a haven, a restful pause, inner renewal, overcoming outer deserts. T.S. Eliot reminds us, so the darkness shall be the light and the stillness the dancing. So instead of hurry, 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 we'd say no hurry, no hurry, no hurry. Because as we know, Saturn opposed Mars, our dread is up and available for cooking, which we'll do very soon. So we can have anticipatory dread, the five-year fear planner, the fear... The fears that we fear that we'll fear far into the future. So anticipatory dread is widely available on the psychic cable station. But as a friend reminds me, that which is important is timeless, and therefore there's no hurry, whereas that which is ephemeral is the illusion of hurry. So it's also, you know, don't step right up, step right in. There's plenty of time. The wonderful 19th century magician Eliphas Levy said, we should conduct ourselves as though we were kings and queens with all eternity before us. It's like, so the moon right now translates this light. And the moon is in Gemini, which reminds us of the Venus station of last summer, which was in Gemini. Very fine work, invaluable work by Daniel Giammario on Venus in this current mountain astrologer, the Venus cycle. And very briefly, there was a very powerful return of Venus in November of 95, 3,600 years of exile as represented by Venus in Scorpio. Something that Venus in Scorpio represents has been exiled from human culture for 3,600 years and now wants back in. The art form of mediating with the invisible. It reminds us also that 3,600 years ago was many things snake goddess everywhere, but also in Crete, a culture that had no evidence of a military, apparent equality between the sexes, and really sexy clothes. So it wants back in. And Venus's retrograde cycle of last summer in Gemini, where she descended, reclaimed her voice. So we'd say something that was exiled 3,600 years ago now has a voice, and now has a voice this night. So we set sail. We're at the oasis, but we also set sail because literally Mars is rising right now. I figured out what due east is. Due east is right here. Mars is rising due east. The moon is overhead. Uranus, Jupiter right down here. So this reminds us also, the late great storyteller Idris Shah gave this story to the West. He died several months ago, and he hands it to us. And it's the story of Fatima the spinner and the tent, and it's very much for us now. Once, in a city in the farthest west, there lived a young girl named Fatima, who was the daughter of a wealthy spinner. And he said to her one day, "Fatima, my good daughter, let's go forth and sail from island to island, and we will trade these things we've been spinning, and we will find you perhaps an eligible, handsome young man for you to marry." So they set forth, and they traveled from island to island. But one day, off the shore of Crete, a terrible storm arose, and the ship was lost. Her father was drowned, and she was cast up on the shore near Alexandria. So she begins her next life. She's picked up by kindly people who bring her home. The quote says, "She could only remember dimly her life until then, for her experience of a shipwreck and exposure in the sea had utterly exhausted her." So a family of clothmakers takes her home, and they teach her their craft, and she spends many years there and makes peace with her lot, her second chapter of life. She was reconciled to her lot. But one day, when walking along the shore, she was plucked from the seashore and captured by slave traders who brought her to Istanbul. Her world had collapsed for the second time. But she's bought by a kindly man who makes masts and who takes her home thinking that he will give her a better life. But when he arrives home, he found that all his fortunes had gone. And so she's given her freedom, and she stays there for several years learning how to make masts. And then he says, "Fatima, you are so good, and you are such a good person with commerce. I want you to take this shipment of masks to Java and sell them at a good price." So she sets sail. When she's off the coast of China, a terrible storm arises, and all is lost, and she's shipwrecked and cast up on the shores of China. Once again, nothing had gone according to expectation. And so she says, "God damn it! Why is it that every time I'm reconciled to my lot, and I still haven't gotten married, that something happens not in accordance with my expectation?" But what she didn't know is there was a legend in China that one day a foreign woman would appear on the shore and be able to build a marvelous building called a tent, which no one had ever seen in China. Now the emperor, and this was awaited with the greatest of anticipation by all the Chinese people. And it just so happened that Fatima is washed up on shore at a time when one of the emperor's ministers is looking for a foreign woman. He finds her, brings her to court, and they say, "It is a prophecy that one day, you know, a woman would arrive who can build a tent." And she says, "Sure, no problem." She says, "First I'll need really strong rope." "Well, we don't have that." She remembers her time as a spinner. She makes the rope. She says, "Well, now I'll need really stout cloth." "Well, we don't have such as you need." And she remembers her time with the clothmakers, and she weaves the canvas. "Well, now I'll need these really long poles." "Well, we don't have that." And she remembers her time with the mast maker. And she remembers from all of her journeys and the apparent cataclysms, all the tents she's ever seen, and she constructs the most beautiful tent. And everyone's ecstatic, and the emperor says, "You know, anything you want, sweetheart, what would you like?" You know, and she goes, "Well, I'll marry you for starters." And she lived in great happiness, but realizing that each apparent catastrophe was the building in of some essential talent for the making of her ultimate happiness and her giving of her gift to the world. And so it is with us, according to the ancient prophecy that we're making up this night. The festival of evolution begins at the end of Fatima's journey, where each one of us gives our gift to the world. And we're invited, the journey really of Fatima is like a 12-year Jupiter cycle. On one level, we're invited to each one of us individually say, "Where was I 12 years ago? You know, and how did I get here from 1985 to 1997? And Jupiter would say, whatever you wanted to do 12 years ago, you weren't ready, and nor was the world, but now you are. And we look back at the last 12 years and tell ourselves our own story of Fatima the tent, and each one of us in the tent, and go, what have I been through all the apparent catastrophes of my life and the interrupted expectations? What is my gift to the world that only I can do, which is as much of a sense of God-given work as anything? So that's a crucial part of it. I think part of right now, Saturn and Aries, you know, with this very positive relationship to Jupiter, Uranus, Aquarius community, says the Aries hero now has the capacity to give that unique gift to the community. And that's the key. That's the festival of evolution. Uranus in Aquarius says it is time to lob liberating esoterica into mainstream, you know. And what we'd say to each one of us also, we'd say the world has needed each one of our unique, crazy, crackpot, intuitive, wild genius, but not entirely welcomed it, you know. But now we enter a time period where the culture is about to be welcoming. And what will that feel like? So not only is the gift of the tent still needed, but about to be welcome. Now, it's important, I think, this idea of giving to the community. The Mayan word for human means one who owes, you know. What is this idea of giving the gift? And how do we, astrology, I think, would define the task of being human as to discern the pattern of evolutionary intelligence, the most lively possibilities inherent in any moment, and line up with that, you know. It's like, again, I think with Uranus and Aquarius, we say the winds are blowing hard, but we have to put up our sail to catch them, you know. And willingness is the ticket, or willingness is the way we hoist our sails, saying, I'm willing, you know, take me into whatever situation I need to be in where I can give my gift and unite with others who have a similar or related gift. And we're reminded also that the word therapy means to heal, of course, but before that, it meant to serve the gods. Again, the serving of the gods, inner and outer. So I think right now, we haven't had a telepathic culture, really, since the 60s, which we've been referring to. And this pattern right now resonates back to 1962, 1969, resonates back to 1914, that we'll be touching on in a moment, and back to the Renaissance. But we'd say we haven't had a truly telepathic popular culture since the 60s, in which, say, the Beatles gave outer expression to the inner psychic reality of a whole lot of people. So now, where do we look? It's everywhere. And we look to Belgrade, for instance. There was a great thing, you know, that the humor and energy on the streets of Belgrade is very electric and very powerful. And everything that comes out of there is like part of us talking to ourselves. So, for instance, 2 weeks ago, the lawyers joined the workers and students on strike. And there was a great 60-year-old just on random on the street who said, this is so exciting. He said, everyone is like a stone or a small brick in the new road that we're building. He said, the energy on the street is so high, everyone is really ready for radical economic change. Another thing that's been pointed out when people look also at Serbia, they say, well, there is no Vaclav Havel. There is no one charismatic leader. And many people in the street say, that's why we've had such a radical constellation of community, because there is no one, there's the group. And the opposition coalition is called Together, so it's the Together Coalition. So it might also be the overcoming of Eastern Europe's addiction to the one strong leader, and that part of ourselves, again, I think part of Neptune, as we know, is in Capricorn, it's the only Earth planet. So the only thing that is grounding us is Neptune. So the only thing that is real is our dreams, you know, and so it certainly invites us to see everything in a kind of precept dream language that, you know, whatever happens to us in our personal lives also is going to make a lot more sense if we preface it by saying, I dreamed that, you know. I dreamed I, you know, had a hard time checking into this hotel disguised as a temple. You know, or I dreamed I was, well, whatever. I dreamed I ran into this other part of myself, that we're all kind of telepathically part of the team. You know, I dreamed I ran into this really annoying part of myself that went, you know, whatever. But I like to kick it open, too, because it also is the idea of the dream news. I think we want different kinds of newses. You know, and those of you who've heard me speak of, you know, I've often said, you know, the Jungian news would be funny, you know, I mean, phallic narcissism rose 8 points today, you know, and then there's the generic news, you know, troops were moving and, you know, whatever. But the dream news would be in which we tell the story of the news as though it is a part of ourselves. I dreamed the illiterate, poor, southern white part of myself were burning down the black Christian spiritual church part of myself. I mean, it puts it into a context where we begin to be able to deal with it on a magical level, too. And again, this, it's an acknowledgement also of complicity. And this idea that on some level we're all complicitous. There's a tendency, of course, to suppress things when we're frightened of them, which makes them more frightening and more toxic. And it's crucial as we enter into the strategical time period of social change, where we'd say it is like a Kairos moment, where everything that everyone does and thinks matters enormously. You know, the forces of greed and darkness and short-term vision are kind of lumbering towards the abyss, like, you know, with the kind of Jupiter Gorge theory of pleasure. No, but the forces of ingenuity and those qualities that make us proud to be human rather than ashamed are sprightly and fast, you know. And you know, so it, nothing is set. We're not working with a fixed future model. You know, it's also the distinction I like to make between prediction and prophecy. Prediction comes from the root word predicament, which is almost always an unpleasant thing. Whereas prophecy connotes, you know, kind of cooperating with the thing. Let's use dark likelihoods as incentives to dream up something better. You know, so when people, call in show or whatever, say, you know, well, here's this gloomy thought about, you know, the Earth's axis is going to tilt, we're all going to die except for people who don't eat meat, you know, whatever. you know, I go, well, do you like that vision? And they go, well, I don't eat meat, so it's okay. But I mean, but it's... But usually they say no, you know, and I go, well, don't vote for it then. You know, we vote for reality with our imagination. Let's cook up something better. I mean, I think part of also what we all know is that this powerful coming together of Neptune and Uranus that has been brewing for 3 years and that Jupiter's the trigger that now explodes it into mainstream culture. You know, revelation and discovery and rewriting of paradigms and rethinking things. And it says wherever we turn our personal or collective attention, there we have breakthrough and realization. So it's precious. You know, it's a precious moment in terms of, you know, where do we direct our attention and where is there breakthrough? So there's this phrase that says, you know, live as though the day were here. You know, and so Neptune and Uranus come together every, you know, 171 years or so, but this is the first time they've come together, Neptune vision, Uranus awakening. When they come together, they say a culture's previous mythology has outlived its utility, it doesn't have the vitality, and it needs to reinvent another one. But this time, this is the first time they've come together that we've known about it, because we hadn't discovered Neptune in the last conjunction. So symbolically, it says this is the first time in human history that we are being invited to consciously create myth. You know, what would that mean? Consciously create with, to cooperate with the invisible or with the gods or what wants to happen or evolutionary intelligence to create myth. So Pluto in Sagittarius says diversity is the cauldron of alchemical change. You know, even in Eastern Europe actually, because it's so kind of rinky-dink and strange and hobbled together, they play the Mission Impossible theme before the news. It's very dear, really, you know. I mean, I think there's something about, of course, that music that is, you know, cheesily exciting, you know, dun, dun, dun. Even though the show, as we remember, was incredibly right-wing, you know, Latin American dictator moving to the left, eliminate him, you know, but still the music is stirring in a cheesy way. But so, you know, astrology is a language of mission, you know, and so it also, Pluto in Sagittarius says we want this feeling that we are all on mission. And that we've been training all our lives, but especially the last 12 years, for our gift and what will happen, this electrical surge of, you know, what's the next step? You know, so it's also like this wonderful phrase, you know, take the zircon to Fapa and tell him we move tonight. You know, so. There's a... So there's a wonderful 19th century utopian named Fourier who said, in any ideal community, we must allow for the passion for intrigue, because when people conspire to pull something off, you know, it draws upon more electrical qualities of their soul than fluorescent lighting or whatever. You know, so this idea of positive intrigue, and it's also that idea of, you know, kidnapping back from the forces of greed, all the sort of sexy fun stuff, you know, intrigue being one of them. So positive intrigue, it's sort of like, you know, the positive aspect of astrology would also say that the universe is this kind of positive, constantly positive thing, and that we want to inculcate an experimental faith in benign paranoia. That actually the universe is a conspiracy for our benefit, you know, and just kind of work with it that way in terms of telling the story. So big mystery, not big certainty is available now. The image for the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction is performer in a ritual mystery play. And by Monday, when wherever we are, I'll be gathering with a group of cohorts here Monday too, but Monday the Jupiter, the Uranus moves into the next degree, which is the cosmic egg. And the egg, of course, was a very powerful image in the Renaissance. They would just put up two arches and hang an egg, and it's a very strong touchstone. The image for Pluto right now is life as a game. Jupiter's games. In games, of course, you want 50-50 fairness, which is what Mars retrograde in Libra right now reminds us. And Chiron also, the image for Chiron, translating back up the ancient Asclepion, the healing temple of incubating the healing dream for self and for community. Its image is a house-raising party. So in Belgrade, they're building the house, you know, and so are we. So brewing beneath the earth, we can really feel it right now, this Uranus-Jupiter-Neptune alignment right below us, right down about here, the moon, the top of our sail, Mars rising. So we feel that force. So it's really like the chrysalis breaks apart and the butterfly emerges and it cleans its wings. You know, I think that's a sense that a lot of us have right now, is like, you know, and just, you know, and then periodic dread, and then back to cleaning. So a wonderful friend of mine who calls himself a Latter-day American symbolist says, and tell those people that, you know, astrology describes our uniqueness and astrology supports us 100%. You know, now, Jung, Uranus is the principle of intuition, and what goes with intuition is anxiety, you know, that kind of ragged hum. And there are a couple of ways to think about that, I think, which is that astrology is a wonderful language because it makes such fine delineations of the inner world and its relationship to the outer world. So it makes a very strong distinction between fear and anxiety, different things. Fear is Saturn, that kind of cold, claustrophobic quality, and the prescription for which is to push back the narrow walls of claustrophobia and kind of kick it open. You know, I'm not going to let the reality police keep me from giving my gift to the world, like, you know, kind of Scarlett O'Hara, hold the EM up kind of thing. And but Uranus and anxiety is the inner gauge or meter that goes up for us when we go away from our intuition. And the idea is, we don't need astrology. There's a part of us that knows the dance choreography steps of the universe and how to dance with it. But we live in such a intuitively and emotionally illiterate culture that we need these remedial tools to remind us of what we know. So if anxiety is the inner gauge or meter that goes up when we go away from intuition, the last thing we want to do is suppress it. You go, you know, large decisions or small, you know, should I go, you know, everyone thinks I should do plan A. How do I feel about it? No. How about plan B? Yep. Now, and again, Uranus, again, the freedom, freeing up from consensus reality is crucial. So Jung said, one's anxiety always points to our task. If you escape it, you've lost a piece of yourself, and a most problematic piece at that, with which the creator of things was going to experiment in unforeseeable ways, you know, kind of wonderful ways. So this consciously creating myth. Emerson says, power resides in the moment of transition from a past to a new state. So we know 1962 was the last time there were five planets in Aquarius, this kind of hum. 1969 was when Jupiter caught up with Uranus and Pluto and explodes what had been sort of cult-like into mainstream. We know that part as crucial, and it also says, you know, telepathic lobbying of art and creativity into the world that is not personality art but essence art, with the attitude of giving, let me be a voice for this, is crucial. But the last time that Jupiter and Uranus were together in Aquarius was 1914, which is quite intriguing. Mars retrograde now in Libra will go back to be in Virgo in this year, 97, which is where Mars was also in 1914. Now, retrograde planets, I like saying that any activity that begins with the letters RE is a good thing to do on a retrograde. Retrieve, rethink, regroup, you know, review, redo 1914. And what was 1914? But it was World War I. It was not the time completely of the invention of radio and the beginning of television and airplanes and whatnot, but it was the beginning of awareness and utilization of them. But it was harnessed into war. Also, interestingly enough, too, 1913, right before, was the beginning of the Federal Reserve Board when it was created, when Jupiter in Capricorn, kind of big fatso Republican kind of thing, was on top of was on top of the U.S. Pluto at 27 Capricorn. And so the Federal Reserve is when actually a bunch of rich people, I mean, it's one of those things that's so invisible that we don't see it, and I don't know nearly enough about it, but there was this wonderful cult book in the 60s called The Illuminatus Trilogy. It was very fun, you know. But one of the good ideas in it, it said, there's a word, fenord, that we are trained not to see when we read it or hear when we hear it, but we're trained from birth, kind of programmed by the forces of darkness, whenever we see it or hear it, we don't know that we have, but it creates this high state of anxiety. So it would be like, you know, Dan Rather saying, good evening, Fenord, and now the Fenord, you know, and so, I think the Federal Reserve Board is a Fenord, actually, because it's like, yeah, okay, I mean, you just gloss over it. But what it was a bunch of rich people actually getting together in 1913 and deciding how to control the economy. I mean, and what they do, I mean, it's extraordinary. They print money, which they loan to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government has to pay it back with interest, which is why they tax us, which is why also the 16th Amendment, which created taxation, was also created in 1913, and the first taxes really happened in 1914. And there was an interesting research project done by a couple of people in 84 that proved that the 16th Amendment, which is about personal tax, was never really ratified. So there are a lot of interesting... Now, Jupiter was on the U.S. Pluto power in 1913, last Jupiter-Uranus conjunction Aquarius, 1914. Neptune right now, you know, is stationing right on that same spot, 27 Capricorn. So it says revision power. You know, Uranus and Aquarius says it is time now to actually begin the experiment of democracy. You know, we've talked about democracy, but there hasn't been democracy. What would that mean? You know, a friend of mine also says the problem with the two-party system is the Democrats give people fish, which creates a kind of dependency. The Republicans teach people how to fish, but then steal the river. You know? So what are the new forms that we would want that would serve this Mars in Libra, this sense of economic justice? I mean, as you know, I have this very frolicsome show on KPFA, which is wonderful. The listenership is wonderful, and people are incredibly supportive. There are the occasional, not crank calls, but cranky calls, in which people go, you know, the world is owned by capitalists and imperialists, you know, how can you dare talk about spirit? And it's an interesting part of all of us that asked that question, and I think that's the crucial part also of anchoring this, you know, what are the implications? But also, the point, the whole kind of alliance, the forming of alliance, the pulse between the concept world and the magical world, the daytime world, the nighttime world, the spiritual world of evolutionary intelligence and our offering ourselves to it, is that that's the unbeatable combination. And that any effective spirit, you know, political change that we've seen has always had its roots in spirit. So this revisioning of power, you know, I think Pluto also in Jupiter's sign says the tax system. We now encourage those things. We do not encourage those things that we want to encourage with taxes, nor do we discourage those things like pollution and greed that we could discourage with taxes. There's a very interesting social activist named David Morris who's on the board of something called the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And he says the greatest gift, okay, like Fatima's tent, of the environmental movement to our culture is the concept of total cost accounting. And what that is, for instance, it's the difference between price and cost. So if you live, for instance, in an area where there's snow, he says, the price of putting salt on the road is very cheap. The cost of putting salt on the road is exorbitant in terms of devastation to infrastructure and cars and, you know, roadside vegetation and pollution of water supply and so on. Price is what an individual pays. Cost is what the community pays. Now, it's also price is visible, cost is invisible. And this idea of the bringing up into visibility. But what happens when you begin to take total cost into it? The city of Los Angeles decided to give a cost to human suffering. They decided to give, I think it was like a quarter per hideous racking coughing episode. They said, oh, that's worth a quarter. But once they did that, once they actually gave a cost to human suffering, they said, you know, we can't afford cars anymore. You know, and they have actually started to implement, you know, 10% of cars must be zero emissions electrical cars, 15% next year, and so on. Other communities have started to do this. I think also Jupiter Uranus has ingenuity contests, and it's that idea of total cost accounting. What this guy David Morris did, he was hired, for instance, to some particular city was going to widen its roads, and he said, well, let me give you the price and the cost. He said the cost is actually $1.5 billion to do that. And he said, do you realize for half that, rather than widen the roads, you could hardwire every home in the entire city, you know, so that people wouldn't have to go anywhere. You know, it's like, rather than build more power plants, build houses that are energy efficient. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, when you begin to look at the total cost. So also the state of California said, well, energy efficiency, that's an interesting idea. I hope we can make money out of it. You know, and... But what they did was they said, well, let's offer $30 million to whoever can come up with a really good, you know, energy efficient refrigerator. $30 million. They did this. It was 2 years ago. And Whirlpool actually came up with it. And it wasn't actually, it didn't get $30 million, but they agreed to provide incredibly efficient refrigerators, $100 each, you know, up to $30 million. So, you know. But again, this idea of Jupiter Uranus as contests and games that begin to draw upon ingenuity. And once you take cost into it, it kicks open all kinds of Jupiter Uranus, kind of like, how could we, you know, with this amount of cost, what else could we do? How fascinating. So full cost accounting, you know, I think it also reminds us that, you know, what I've been talking about for years is this five degree hum. Sort of says collapse of infrastructures is the compost pile for, you know, ingenuity and creativity to rise upon. And it reminds us that, you know, Rome was not sacked in a day. So that's part of it. Now, David Morris also says, you know, that the part of the whole idea also Jupiter's this concept of wealth. And he says the failure of recycling. He says recycling is too much kind of a hippie thing. What you have to think of is scrap-based manufacturing. And he's implemented this in a number of cities. And what it is you have mining, which is curbside collection. You have processing, manufacturing, wholesale retail. So there are communities everywhere, or many communities, there's about 20, that have done this. And where the community itself, the inner city community, has started to make a really sizable profit from not just the recycling pit, which is a losing thing, but the whole Jupiter sweep. And they basically mined and manufactured lumber from plastic picked up at curbside that they then built playgrounds with, and then also saw. And so it's also this idea of Jupiter's wealth. And Jupiter also, as we know, is about circulation. So a lot of colleagues I have who are inner city activists say the problem of most communities is not needing more wealth. It's about circulation of wealth and containers to hold it. Now, what's known is that in a wealthy community, $1 will circulate 8 times before it leaves. In an inner city poor community, $1 circulates 80 cents and it's gone through lotteries and liquor stores and drug dealers and whatnot. And so it's again that this idea of Jupiter and Uranus sextile, Saturn in Aries, the containers, the innovative form of the container to hold the wealth. Now, and friends of mine, again, who do inner city work, community activist work, you know, they approach a group and they say, what's your wealth? And people are confounded, you know, because they usually ask, what's your problem? And they go, what's your wealth? And, you know, and they go, well, yeah, who knows how to build a tent? Who has electrical skills? Who knows how to do this? How do we reform these things? And the discovery of hidden wealth through innovative containers is crucial. You know, as we know, in many Native American languages, there is no word for garbage. I mean, the concept does not exist. So, And also this idea of least cost planning, you know, building energy efficient houses and so on, inventiveness contests. Now, the shadow, of course, is growth. And one of the principles of inner city also organizing is that development never pays for itself. You know, this shuffling around of huge amounts of capital, you know, build a stadium, you know, but there's no container for it. So I think also part of Jupiter Uranus says it is time for the wise to become wealthy. Now, and as we know, by our own definition, by our own Saturn definition, as we know, money is not the sum of wealth. You know, what is a wealthy life? And how would each one of us define that? Because Jupiter says to us, you know, I will make you a wealthy person if you define what that would mean. And then by extrapolation, again, the astrology is always about the individual and its relationship to the collective. The nobility of hard, difficult challenges or aspects in our lives is that whatever we can resolve or get to dance together, you know, grants us the spiritual muscle tone to participate in rewriting the larger cultural script. So we start, you know, first and spread out, you know, what is each one of us, my, you know, definition of a wealthy life? And then we begin to say, well, and what would be the definition of a wealthy culture? So beginning by asking these questions is important. It's like a great colleague of mine, Swami Beyondananda, says, you know, a lot of good-hearted people have to learn how to heal their inner Republican. So now, Mars retrograde in Libra is, I think, this interesting, it's this pulse of reciprocity is the idea between the night dream world and the day concept. Dreams translate into the day world through incarnational garments of imagery, you know, which is what we provide for them, and then they become real. And in traditional astrology, Mars in Libra is called in its fall. But if you think about it, you know, Mars in Venus's sign, well, you know, how could it be in its fall? If we think of all the other fall attributes, Neptune in Virgo, the vision must be grounded. Uranus in Leo says, you know, any community must be comprised of shining, radiant individuals. You know, Pluto in Taurus says power must be stewarded and honored. And when we make beautiful things, then power and magic come to live there. So Mars retrograde in Libra also is about the peacemakers, waging peace. And I think it also reminds us that at the end of the Arthurian legend cycle, the legend states that Arthur did not die. He goes to Avalon to hang out, you know, with the witchy women, to await the summon at a crucial historical time when we call, you know, King Arthur back. And I'd say now might be a good time. You know, I think it's why, you know, one story we might tell is why most interesting guys like to hang out mostly with women. I don't know, you know, I mean, it's a kind of King Arthur thing. So Mars in Libra says, of course, you know, custodian of the Aikido truth, that the aggressor always loses, which is a traditional Mars retrograde description. But there's also a wonderful Aikido truth that says she or he who dances most intimately with the chi of the universe is safest and most effective. So this is, again, Mars in Libra opposed Saturn, dread can be up, but it says engagement and dancing most intimately with the chi of the universe makes us safe and most effective. Now, I think also, just as a footnote too, Mars in Libra might be a return to at least civilized, witty aggression. One of the best examples, I think, was many of you might know this, but in the English Parliament, Gladstone said to Disraeli, "Sir, you will either die upon the gallows or a venereal disease." And without missing a beat, Disraeli said, "That depends, sir, upon whether I embrace your principles or your mistress." You know, it's like more of that would be fun. I mean, I think that would be a good thing. So the sort of sublimation of, you know, it's like a friend of mine says, the English don't know that much about pleasure, but they really know about sublimation. You know, and so again, that idea of, you know, sublimating. So Mars is retrograde in Libra, trine Jupiter Uranus. Sinn Féin, you know, the sort of political branch of the IRA, in a sense, has just come out also with a very interesting document called Putting People First about community activism. And I also like to quip that Sinn Féin is Irish feng shui. It's sort of... But Sinn Féin also has come out with this thing, the role of the community in economic development, a vision of socialist republic that grants economic justice. But their language is very different. It just came out 2 days ago. The language is very different. It's interesting. They say, we want to create a society that cherishes all people equally and prizes equality and social justice. You know, prizes is very Jupiter concept. Equality, completely Uranus concept. You know, and social justice, very Mars Libra. So this idea of holding people to that. Now Mars retrograde also is rituals of reconciliation. You know, go back to heal the past. Interesting, Larry Dossey, who basically proved the efficacy of prayer, said that recent physics experiments have implied that we can actually change the past by praying about it. It's interesting also that at this time period of Jupiter Uranus, okay, revelation of truth, revelation of stories, things surface. You know, we have the people who killed Steve Biko in South Africa. 5 policemen just came forward and confessed. You know, in South Africa, they have this extraordinary Mars and Libra, this ritual. It's called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You know, and their banner says, you know, healing our past. And it's, again, very tricky because it is easy, as a friend of mine saw on some kind of Oprah-like show, you know, that was on, you know, I don't know, wife abuse or whatever, and the man basically came out, you know, this man who had beaten up his wife for years and said, well, I just think we should both put this behind us, as I have. You know, it's like, you know, so it's a tricky thing. You know, again, the truth comes out, and then what are appropriate rituals that don't just, you know, cover it over again, but actually do get to the source of it. But I think this idea also of Jupiter Uranus, you know, for years we've been, many astrologers I think have been saying, you know, Jupiter Uranus, this is the time period where bills come due, you know, a collapse of systems. And I would, just as a popular footnote, I'd say, well, OJ got a pretty big bill actually recently. And but that part of ourselves also, the bills come due. But it's also been the time of change of stories, change of paradigms, rewriting the past, you know, opening things up. The Hubble spacecraft reminds us that the further out we look, we're actually looking back in time. Okay, we're extending our gaze out and back simultaneously. And in light of that, very interesting also this last week too, you know, front page thing in Washington Post that was about recent revelations from, there was a Chilean discovery of human presence 12,500 years ago on this, no, South America, North America thing, which is a good 1,500 years earlier than had been thought. And the Smithsonian said, this totally changes how we think of the prehistory of America. Our models clearly are not right. Prominent skeptics went down to go, oh, blah, 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 this is probably good, this could, and they were like, ooh, wow. And so a prominent skeptic who said very unlike, you know, saw the evidence and went, no, this is very interesting, and told the news conference, this work was a kind of paradigm buster and a new benchmark in knowledge. Now, so again, it's this sort of, the Hubble extends our gaze, so we're actually looking back at the birth of galaxies. Also, again, Jupiter Uranus, just on the kind of very modern level too, recent revelations from formerly secret documents, you know, the newspaper headline says, stain of ties to Holocaust spreading across Europe, money trails point to profits by neutrals. It's about Europe's collaboration and complicity, basically, the paper trail of Nazis to European profit from genocide, now wants to be looked at. It's like, let's look at this. You know, and this is a very volatile time about issues of social justice and truth. And it, again, it's that idea of bringing things up where they can be dealt with. There's a powerful inscription on the monument in the tidal basin in Washington by Thomas Jefferson. It says, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever. So Mars retrograde opposed Saturn is about fear. You know, it's also kind of Jungian concept is whatever we take an interest in takes an interest in us. In the same way, you know, so it's good to have a friendly relationship to the unconscious. But I think also what Mars opposed Saturn reminds us of, another RE retrograde reminds us of, is the whole concept of a last judgment, which we find pretty much a post-mortem measurement is pretty much found in all cultures, an encounter with the self. And it's about have we achieved authentic truthfulness with ourself. You know, in Egypt, the soul, is weighed against a feather by Mat, you know, the goddess of truth. Kind of Uranus and Aquarius quality that only the truth works now. We're all in telepathic contact, you know, lies with this tremendous dissonant hum, like, and if we're in touch with our own sense of anxiety, we go, something's funky, no. Now, if one's soul was measured against the feather and it balanced, a very Mars and Libra concept, then you were escorted triumphantly to Osiris. But if your soul went, you know, clunk, then you were eaten immediately, you know, by a monster. So we might say there's a last judgment for all, personal and collective in a sense. You know, Jupiter really likes trials, and Uranus likes truth, and Mars is in Libra. So we have a kind of reprieve, I think, also, too. Mars goes back into Virgo in the course of this year, just like in 1914. What will we do with ingenuity? Will we wrestle back our wealth into our communities and determine where wealth is meant to go rather than into war? You know, or will we not? And this reprieve, I think, also, will we live our authentic lives or will our souls go clunk? You know, will we live in a state of anxiety that we don't talk to and go, why am I so anxious? I must not. We think of anxiety as like the grain of sand in the oyster that creates the pearl, or the tension, you know, that is necessary to generate the energy for change. You know, and part of what the gods would speak to all of us now is we don't need to worry about how. How am I going to change? How am I going to leave this thing? You know, it says if we concentrate on what, then avenues of possibility open up ingeniously. I think very important also, Mars in Libra, the strategy of negotiation, says in our own personal lives or in larger collective lives, we could all pretty much probably agree on a vision of what the world should look like. You know, cities blooming and everyone well fed and restoration of the gene pool. It's when we get to how that we go to war. You know, do that, again, illusion of scarcity. So the instructions say start with what, and invisible avenues of opportunity of what wants to happen begin to open up for us. So this last judgment and the reprieve, Mars retrogrades back, but then comes to its direct opposition to Saturn at the end of July. So in a sense, I'd say, you know, this is the time in our own lives to get ourselves straight and honest with ourselves, and also in that determination of where do we choose for culture to put its attention, its ingenuity, its breakthrough, and its wealth. Now, there's a great quote from Emerson in a wonderful book by Edward Edinger called The Anatomy of the Psyche, and it's about alchemical symbolism, wonderful book. And in his chapter on the mortificatio, something has to die. It's like in a tragedy in Act 4, something must die so that Act 5, something can come back to life. But Emerson, in his essay on compensation, says, all infractions of love and equity in our social relations are speedily punished. They are punished by fear. While I stand in simple relation to my fellow man, I have no displeasure in meeting him. But as soon as there is any departure from simplicity, an attempt at halfness, or good for me that is not good for him, my neighbor feels the wrong. He shrinks from me as far as I have shrunk from him. His eyes no longer seek mine. There is war between us. There is hate in him and fear in me. All the old abuses in society, universal and particular, all unjust accumulations of property and power are avenged in the same manner. Fear is an instructor of great sagacity and the herald of all revolutions. One thing he teaches, that there is rottenness where he appears. He is a carrion crow, and though you see not well what he hovers, there is death somewhere. Now Jung, in a 1952 interview, said the opus magnum, okay, the great work, had two aims, the rescue of the human soul and the salvation of the cosmos. But in any alchemical work, the first encounter is with the negredo, the demon, the dread, the fear. Now, and so how can paralytic fear keep us from giving our gift to the world, you know, to all our relations? I think that that's very engaged right now, too, in which, you know, a lot of us can say, you know, why do I work so hard at not having a good time? You know, what is this demon or this impediment or this assignment, you know? And it is this trick of the reality police. So a friend of mine gives me this image also from classical alchemy, and it's the image of the negredo. And what it says is that there comes a point in the classical alchemical experiment where the alchemist, each one of us in a sense, is holding the pot, and it begins to violently seethe, and it polarizes into white and black. And out of it come these vapors that fill the world with the moral ambiguity of the dream state, and it's terrifying. And the alchemist might drop the pot, but then have to start all over again. But instead, what the alchemist must do is reach up and grab whatever we want to think of it, Jupiter, Uranus, crown chakra, Holy Spirit, kind of inspiration, bring it into the pot, you know, and then we can have a mature person, a mature culture. So it's not so much new age, but coming of age, you know, as maybe a more fun kind of concept. And in this wonderful poem by Theodore Rothke, and he says, it's called In a Dark Time. In a dark time, the eye begins to see. And he goes on, what's madness but the nobility of soul at odds with circumstance? The day is on fire. I know the purity of pure despair. My shadow pinned against a sweating wall, that place among the rocks, is it a cave or a winding path? The edge is what I have. A steady stream of correspondences, a night flowing with birds, a ragged moon, and in broad day the midnight come again. A man goes far to find out what he is. Death of the self in a long, tearless night. All natural shapes blazing unnatural light. Dark, dark my light, and darker my desire. My soul, like some heat-maddened summer fly, keeps buzzing at the sill. Which I is I? A fallen man, I climb out of my fear. The mind enters itself, and God the mind, and one is one in the tearing wind. So the festival of evolution begins at the end of our Fatima's journey, where we conjure the force to give our gifts. There's an alchemical saying that says, sublimate, you know, air, raise up, sublimate the body and coagulate earth, the spirit. So sublimate the body and coagulate the spirit. Transcend fear, bring Jupiter, Uranus down, earthing the spirit in the cauldron. Now it's very much, and what we're about to do is very much really like Pentecost. You know, in the Bible it says, and there appeared unto them cloven tongues as of fire, and it sat upon each of them, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues, and the Spirit gave them utterance. So, as many of you know, who played with me before, is, you know, we've all been subjected to hokey rituals, you know, and we don't want to do that. So I'm going to suggest our closing finale, and no one has to do anything. Only if you want your life to work will you now stand up. And in your left hand, imagine that you're holding the alchemical vessel. And your right hand, without bonking your neighbor, you extend up. And we say to Jupiter Uranus, reveal to us the story of how it turns out okay, the exuberance to participate, and the connectedness to energetic allies and teammates. And now, just for a moment, while the drum drums, just with half-closed eyes, imagine the seething cauldron and imagine reaching up and gathering the force which each one of us needs and which we all need. On the count of three, imagine and also bring your right hand down into the seething cauldron. One, two, three, bring it down. And we end with Dante's words to us at the end of the Divine Comedy. But by a lightning flash, my mind was struck, and thus came the fulfillment of my wish. My will and my desire were both revolved, as is a wheel in even motion driven by love which moves the sun and other stars. Thank you for doing this great work.